How would you define family so that it incorporates the people that you've listed in yours? Okay, go through that a piece at a time. Okay, a group of people. Okay, they share some sort of emotional connection over a period of time. Okay, so, and whose actions affect each other. They affect the other people and are affected by them. Okay, other examples? You wrote. What'd you write?
Consists of those immediately related to you, your parents and siblings, or it can include all to whom you are related, your immediate family and your grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins.
Okay, so the notion is that it can include all the people who are related to you, either the immediate family, which you defined, or your extended family. So the degree of relationship to you may vary, so you may define a family as being the immediate, those people who are immediately related, parents and siblings, or those who are more distantly related. And by relation there, you mean a biological kinship. So the reproductive line from which you descend.
That holds true, but I also think that friends are people who aren't necessarily related to you can be considered family.
Okay, so, and she used a head. She said it can. She didn't say it only. So, good thinking there. And you're suggesting that it doesn't need to be restricted to the reproductive relationship, but might include friends as well, because you consider them as family. Okay. Other definitions?
Well, I put family for me was a person of group of people that you're either related to by blood, and therefore, because you've known them most, you're likely to develop a loving and caring relationship, or throughout your life, or someone who you're not necessarily related to by blood, but have the same strong, like, loving and caring relationship with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so, and by blood, you don't mean a group of vampires. You mean the kinship or the genetic relationship that makes us related to each other by DNA. We characteristically call that by blood, which is kind of a strange way of putting it, actually, but we all use it, and it assumes that we share blood when in fact it's really genes and chromosomes, maybe related by sperm and ovum. I don't know how the blood got in there, but maybe some historic-minded person can fill us in on that. But you also then want to include, I think you attached to the notion of being related by blood, some notion about caring and loving or sharing.
Mm-hmm. college. Like, I don't, I think it could be a relationship with them if you're investing in the person that I
So you want to have some kind of emotional relationship in addition to, or you want to allow the emotional relationship to stand by itself without the kinship relationship. So it's either or, but nobody without the emotional relationship? You want to exclude those people? Okay, so you want to define it from your perspective as people that you can rely on and that you feel close to. Okay, so it perhaps starts in the biology of reproduction, but then gets extended over time to include those people that you affiliate with or people that you marry, so you're not related to them biologically, at least in the current generation, though you may become related to them biologically through succeeding generations, which raises an interesting question. You know, we talk about our descendants, but are we also related to our ancestors, whom we descend from, which means that everybody back there is related to us genetically and their family, and that's fairly easy. But do we also include our descendants, the people who will descend from us? And that's fairly easy. I consider my children and grandchildren part of my family. But do I then crawl up their family tree that they've joined themselves to by marriage? So do I have to include my daughter's in-laws as part of my family? My grandchildren clearly have two sets of grandparents. Does that make us related because we share grandchildren? Are we part of the same family? So just hold that. Other observations? The group of people who support each other as a unit or as a household. So you want to substitute household and you want to include which kinds of support, financial or emotional? And if they don't, they're not part of your family. Okay. So do you want to attach those people who do support you financially and emotionally, even though they're not related by kinship? You want to include those as part of your family because of the support, so they can buy your way in, their way into your family. Okay. Okay. Yeah, I would let them in if the price is good. If you support me, I'll let you into the family. Other thoughts? Okay. So what you've done is taken about half the lid off a can of worms, because defining family is an interesting challenge. What questions did you have about whether or not to include somebody? Who were you questioning? Nobody? Yes. Okay. The cousin's ex-husband. And the question is, if you can get into the family by marrying, does divorce exclude you? And that's an important question in looking at post-divorce adjustment for children and other people. You know where I get all my information about families and relationships, right? And if you want to know what I'm going to lecture about, just read Dear Annie in the Free Press, the successor to Dear Abby and Dear Abigail Van Buren. What was her name? Anyway, the two people who took over for the Lonely Hearts Twins, to answer all of your relationship questions, have a lot of interesting stories in there and questions that come in. And one of them in the last couple of weeks was specifically about inviting a family member's ex to a wedding. And she had been told in no uncertain terms by somebody in the family that that was not permissible because he was no longer a member of the family because he had been divorced. And this writer was having difficulty with that. So it's a question that other people share with you. Does divorce throw you out of the family? And does it throw you out of part of the family, since it's obviously not going to throw you out of being your children's family member, if you have children, but does it throw you out of your in-laws' family if you get divorced, or out of the cousins' family? Other questions that came up about who to include? How many of you included the dog? Okay. If the dog thinks it's a people, then you probably have to include it. But some people will have difficulty with that.
Well, my mom's best friend from when she was little married my dad's brother's wife's sister.
I'm not even going to try to follow.
But, I mean, I'm not related to either of them by blood or whatever. Uh-huh.
So the example is your mom's best friend from childhood married your dad's brother's sister-in-law's sister. So we're two steps removed on that side, and so it's a pretty distant relationship by marriage, but you spend a lot of time together, so maybe they qualify as family. Okay. Other questions that came up? The horse. None of the pets are going to qualify as dependents for tax purposes, no matter how much you spend on them. It's not going to happen. If you have offspring by one of your pets, we're not going there. We don't know what to do with half-human species yet, but I'm sure that biologically we will get there someday. And I hope the medical ethicists are dealing with that and the legal folks now. So, you know, if I am able to procreate with a mountain gorilla and... what is it? I'm not going there. But those are the sorts of questions that do bother the ethicists that I'm glad they do. And I want them to be well ahead of the curve before our technology gets to that point where we can create a new species. Okay? What you are wrestling with are some of the things that we regularly wrestle with in human development of family studies and in sociology, and people take different approaches to trying to define what it is that makes the family or a family. And the article that I just emphasized, the family or a family, it is a very important article. Okay? If you are talking about the family with a single definition, then you have to be very careful about your definition if you're going to define the family and make your definition fit all families. You're going to have to defend it. If you want to define a family and allow for diversity and difference of opinion, then you can be a little sloppier in your definition and some people will still criticize you for that. How you define family is a very important political, economic, and legal issue. It is not a semantic discussion that is just fun to have without practical implication. The Census Bureau, for example, tried for years, decades, to come up with a definition of family, and they do not define family because they can't. So the Census Bureau counts households or people or children, but they can't define a family, so they count households. And then they make some more or less inaccurate assumptions about people who share a household, that they support each other, that they perhaps have a sexual relationship with each other. And every 10 years they come up with new definitions about how to define relationships, because they're not happy and the sociologists and the demographers aren't happy with what they've come up with ever, because you can't please everybody. And it depends on your purposes. Legally, it's important because families have legal rights in some jurisdictions, or there are legislators who will try to define legal rights for families and responsibilities and privileges, and then get into the hassle of figuring out, well, how do you define it, because you want to exclude some people from the category because you don't want them to have the rights. So if you define the rights as being attached to families, then you're left with the legal problem of defining what a family is. And if that's not incorporated in your state or federal constitution, then you're in deep trouble when you try to define who gets the rights and who does not. So in fact, most family law has nothing to do with families. I get a big book every other year when Vermont finishes its two-year state legislative term, session, they call it. I get the updated version of family law in Vermont. And it's very interesting to read, if you like reading that kind of stuff. It's interesting politically to read because, in fact, most of the laws do not use the word family, and they don't refer to family. They refer to parents and children. They refer to husbands and wives, or civil unioned couples, partners. They refer to grandparents. They refer to genetic relationships. They refer to adoption. They refer to marriage, to civil union. But they don't refer to family because they can't. They can't agree. Legislators can't agree on how you would define a family. But you can define a parent-child. You can define adoption. You can define marriage. You can define civil union. You can define a household. And if you make your list long enough, you can define who is related to whom closely enough so that they have some rights and responsibilities to each other. Right. Right. And some of us are, for those of you listening on the web, the observation is that some of us have relatives with whom our relationship may be more like that of a different kinship relation than the one that actually obtains. In this case, a cousin who actually grew up with you pretty much in the same way that a sister would have. So where do you include her? Many of us have that situation. Many of us are raised with people who serve as our parents, who are in fact our aunts and uncles, or grandparents. Some of us are raised and have a parental relationship with half-siblings from previous marriages of one of our parents. There are all kinds of possibilities. And the fact that there are so many ways to be related, even biologically, and those are not, they do not correspond one-to-one with psychological relationships, it makes it very confusing. Because there is so much variety in the kinds of relationships that we have and the basis for those relationships, and that's why we end up not being able to define family. Unless we're forced to. In the first reading that you have, Garbarino and Abramovitz, chapter from Garbarino's book, the chapter you have is called The Family as a Social Institution. Garbarino provides his definition, which is something like people related by blood or legal tie, by which he means adoption or marriage. Marriage will do it too, right? Okay. And then he says, you know, there's a lot of fudge in there because he's trying to be respectful of diversity and inclusive. And in fact, what he's used, and I like Jim very much, we're friends and we have interesting discussions. What he's done is exclude a whole bunch of people from your families and other families, because he's bought into and repeats in the chapter, which we'll look at in a little more detail, probably not today, but we'll look into more detail after break. What he's included there, what he's bought into, is the notion that family is defined by parenting and child rearing. And most of the people that he quotes in the chapter have done the same thing. And what they have finessed is a whole set of issues that you have raised, such as, is it kinship or is it love and sharing and support? Is it support or is it a legal or kinship bond? Is it something that is defined by law or by kinship or both? How extensive is it? And does it have to include children? When I stop parenting, or my kids die, if I'm a young parent and I don't have any children, do I no longer have a family? Do I not get to participate in one unless I go out and become a step-parent? There are a whole series of questions that are raised by his definition, which is a fairly common definition of, if it's genetically related or legally bound, there's a legal contract, then it's family, nothing else is. I don't like that. I think we can be much more inclusive than that. And I think we need to take very seriously the variety of people that you've included and the variety of questions that you have raised, and take seriously in this way. Okay, so here's my definition, because I'm going to be asked. Family is a group of people related to each other by blood, the genetic kinship. Legal bond, marriage, civil union, adoption, or foster contract. And you still get to be family even if you're in a state that says by its constitution you can't get married and they don't recognize Vermont civil unions. Okay. Or, and this is my addition to try to get at the emotional connections, that many of you use to define who's in your family, the good friends, the people who kind of got adopted in, mutual commitment to each other. And that definition, as it says, you don't have to agree with. It's the one I'm going to use in this course. And I use it because it is the most inclusive that I can come up with and still require me to define the relationships between family members. But I get three different ways to define them, which gives me a pretty inclusive set of possibilities. Okay, but this is not a legal definition. It is not an accepted sociological definition. It's the one that I use because it works for me and it works in the context of this course. What it excludes is people who aren't related in either the kinship way, biological kinship way, or the legal way, and who don't have any kind of sense that they're part of your family, even though you consider them to be. This definition says they're not there because it's not a mutual commitment. Yeah. In other words, you can't adopt people who don't want to be adopted into your family and call them family just because you want to. And that one's arguable. I used to argue it more vehemently than I do now, but it lets me cover most everybody. Does that definition cover almost everybody that you wanted to include in your family? Without getting too specific about what a commitment is. It's a fun thing about being an academic, you have to define everything. So we can talk about commitment. Now, what I tried to do over the years crafting and refining and more recently just defending this definition is to allow for the fact that many of us consider ourselves to be parts of families that do not involve children as parents. Many of us live in what we consider to be families that are composed of people who are not related biologically and do not have a legal relationship with each other. Okay. There are an awful lot of cohabiting people in the United States. There are a lot of people who are living in sin without benefit of legal bond. In some states, after 7 or 9 years, if you live together as man and wife, and hear that as a heterosexual definition, if you live together as man and wife, you actually do acquire the legal bonds that apply to married couples. It's called a common law marriage. And if you assert that you are entitled to those, and you've lived together as man and wife for 7 years or 9, depending on the state will call you married. They'll call it a common law marriage. Vermont is not one of those states. You can live together for 30 years, have 10 kids together, and you are not related to each other legally. And you have no marital rights in Vermont. Period. So, if you build a house, create something together, have kids, but don't have a legal contract called a marriage certificate, and the other person dies, you don't get anything. And you have no legal grounds for wanting anything if it's not legally in your name. So if you build a house but it's in his name, unless he has a will that leaves it to you, you don't get it. His children, even though they're also your children, his children do inherit everything, and you don't, even though you're their mother, because we don't recognize common law marriage. So if you don't have it in writing, it doesn't exist in Vermont. Yes. That depends on whether the court wants to appoint you as guardian for them as the inheritors. They don't have to.
Well, what other rights do they have?
You would be their legal parent.
Yeah.
But if they inherit, then it depends on the state deciding that somebody is going to hold that property or money or whatever it is in trust for them if there's no will. Yeah. But it gets very complicated. It's a good reason to have a contract and a will, because then you can specify, if you have a will, for example, you can specify who will be responsible for your property and take care of it for your children. You can even cut the other parent out, and many people do that, especially if they've separated, but you can write them in as the trustee for the minor children. But that's a legal definition. It's not something that automatically happens. It has to be done, in fact, either by you before you die or in court by a probate judge who's taking care of the property and the heirs. Especially if you don't have a will. If you don't have a will, the state defines who's going to get it, and it's based on the relationship between you. And they will carve it up in nice, neat ways, if there is anything to carve up. Okay, my point is that many of us have children, many of us have relationships with other people with whom we do not have a legal connection. Many of us are step-parents psychologically to other people's children to whom we are not married. We have no legal relationship or genetic relationship to somebody else's children if we're not married to that person. Okay. So, in fact, in Vermont, one of the issues that comes up occasionally is that somebody is living in sin, shacking up with somebody else, and that person's children, it's not my language, it's your grandmother's language. She doesn't want you to do it. Okay. So you're taking care of these children, and you have no legal relationship to them, and no biological relationship to them, and their parent dies, and their other parent is already gone, and you have no legal standing until the state appoints you their guardian. And the state may choose not to do that. And you have no legal legs to stand on in that situation. Because you're not biologically their parent, you're not legally their parent, so you have no legal standing in relationship to them as a step-parent. You may be able to adopt them if they're now orphans, but if somebody else in the family wants to claim kinship and responsibility, then you may have a battle about who's going to adopt the children that you've been taking care of since they were perhaps quite young. So these are not trivial issues, and what I've tried to do in this definition is to be as inclusive as possible, to include civil unions, to include homosexual relationships, with or without children, and that's about as far as I'll go. Then we look at one of the reasons why we can't agree . Remember the mesosystem and the ecosystem were defined from the specific person's perspective? So if something is going to be a setting in your exosystem or your mesosystem, that depends on your specific relationship to that setting. A family also has to be defined from the perspective of the person or persons who are in it. So I asked you to write down who was in your family. It might be interesting for you to ask a parent and a sibling within your family to do the same thing and see if your lists overlap. And they might. They might not. It's an interesting exercise to do. The farther away you get from your immediate family, the less likely your lists are to overlap. So, who's in your family depends on your personal perspective and the nature of the relationships that you have, the dyadic relationships that you have with each of those people. And those change over time. So your family is a dynamic and fluid grouping of people. People come into it and people leave it. Those changes are happening regularly. One of the interesting things to do is to look back at the nature of your family of origin when you were born. And then look at it 10 years later. And then look at it 20 years later. And look at it 10 years beyond that. So every 10 years, look at the structure of that family. Who's in it and how are they related? And you find that it's constantly changing. If you have siblings, or people get divorced, people get married, they bring other people and relationships into your family. The sociologists are likely to talk about two kinds of families, the family of origin and the family of procreation. The family of origin is the one you were born into. And at that point, it's relatively easy for most of us to define the genetic kinship relationships that we have to people in that family of origin. They're all either our parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, siblings. So it's fairly easy because we're tracing what is, from our perspective, one family tree back, but it's branching. The family of procreation, to a sociologist, is the family in which you have children. So it's the one you create when you marry and have children. And as Garbarino says in that chapter, the traditional norm, that is what we expect, is for a man and a woman to marry and have children. And that creates a family of procreation. You're going to read an article by Stephanie Kuntz. You're going to read another article by, blocking on her first name, Hodder, about the family as it really is. And when I say, in Garbarino's view, there is a traditional norm, it's important that we think of that as a traditional fantasy norm of husband and wife getting married and then having children. It's a fantasy norm because it has applied more or less over the years and typically much less than people would like to think. And it still does. I was very surprised about 15 years ago we started a workshop for divorcing and separating parents in Vermont, and I was startled. The judges who were ordering people who were separating, parents who were separating, to come into this workshop were very clear that they wanted it not to be just for parents who were divorcing, but parents who were separating or establishing parentage. Establishing parentage is what you have to do when you conceive a child together and want to make public who its parents are and therefore who it has inheritance rights with and who is responsible for supporting it. And I thought, okay, well, that's probably important. I didn't realize that we started in one of the rural counties in Vermont, and after we'd been doing the pilot project for several months, we were counting up how many people were in the workshop because they were divorcing, and how many were in the workshop because they were already divorced but were rearranging their parenting arrangements, and how many people were there because they were establishing parentage. And it turned out that well over a third of the couples that we were dealing with had never been married. They had children, and they were separating, or they'd never lived together in many cases. But well over a third had not been married. So they weren't divorcing. They couldn't divorce because they weren't married. But they were establishing parentage for their children. And that was interesting because I was at the time teaching, I still teach a course on parenting through separation and divorce, and one of the issues that raised was that almost all of the research literature on the effects of divorce on children misses anywhere from 15 to 40% of children whose parents have separated. Because every study uses the divorce process to identify kids. But then there are all these other hundreds of thousands of kids whose parents were together and then separate, and they go their way. And the kids go through very much the same experience, but it's not a divorce, so they don't get counted. So it skews all of the literature, depending on which way you want to interpret it. But it means there are an awful lot of kids in the non-divorced group who have gone through the same thing that the kids in the divorce group have gone through. And I check that occasionally with other states and other people who work in that field, and there are an awful lot of people out there having children who've never been married. So did they not have a family of procreation because they didn't marry and then have kids? Well, it's a traditional norm, so we don't have to worry about it. What about all those people who marry and don't have children? Are they not a family? What about all those people who marry people who already have children, but they don't have any children of their own, which includes a large number of the remarried couples in this country? Are they not a family? Because the traditional norm says two people get married and then they have children, and that's a family. And if they don't have children, it's not a family. And if the children are somebody else's, then what do we do with that? So what it does is leave out all the unmarried couples and all the couples who have children who aren't married, and all the people who are married but don't have children together. They're not a family of procreation. So we needed some kind of concept. My suggestion is that we have a third kind of family, which is actually very prevalent, which is a family of affiliation. It's one that we choose to be in, and we'll call it a family if we choose to, and we won't worry about it because the sociologists aren't going to study as much anyway. And that includes your grandparents who are going to cohabit rather than get married in their widow. How many of you have grandparents who have been widowed? And how many of them, I won't tell. Let me do it this way. Do any of them have partners they live with that they're not married to? That is a very common status for many older people. They live with partners They live in sin, and for many of them it's a problem because they've told you not to live in sin. They don't want you cohabiting, and there they are, cohabiting in a sexual relationship with somebody that they're not married to. And the reason they're not married to is A, they don't believe in remarriage because they're widowed, or they're Catholic and can't get a divorce, or all of these things happen. Or it's financially disadvantageous to them because they lose pension rights from previous marriages if they remarry. Or it reduces their Social Security. So rather than pay through the nose to get married, they choose not to marry and live with the conflict of that. So have a great spring break. When you come back, we will tackle families and love.